You know, this is, excuse me, a damn fine cup of coffee.
I don't need you to tell me how good my coffee is, okay?
Hello, and welcome to A Damn Fine Cup of Culture. And joining me today is Julie.
Hello.
And Matt.
Hello.
And today we'll be discussing that most cynical of genres, film noir. Each of us has picked an American film that we feel represents the genre, and it's a selection that spans six decades of Hollywood filmmaking. So I looked up the dictionary definition of film noir, a style or genre of cinematographic film marked by a mood of pessimism, fatalism, and menace. So I was wondering what your definitions of film noir was and how that influenced the film you picked. Start with Matt.
I would actually have said that the most cynical of genres is probably the romantic comedy, but that's, you know, beside the point. What is noir? And I think, you know, this very quickly then goes into a discussion about genre, and very often genre discussions are just masturbatory, and probably the only one who would really enjoy an in-depth discussion of what is a genre would be me. I think noir for me is as much of a mood, a tone, perhaps an iconography, as it is a genre, perhaps even more so. It's, you know, I expect certain tropes, I expect certain images, I expect crime, amorality, heart-bitten cynical anti-heroes, femme fatale, patsies. I kind of expect a 1940s, 50s look and feel, something jazzy, cigarette smoke, high contrast cinematography. You know, light and dark in the images, but the morality is grey and everyone is compromised. So I expect something bleak, pessimistic, existentialist, perhaps even nihilist. But very often I think underneath all of that, there is a kind of disappointed romanticism. Not in all of them, but definitely in some of the films we'll be discussing. So these are the kind of things I associate with noir. Obviously films like the ones we'll be discussing, but also Citizen Kane, then neo-noir like L.A. Confidential, postmodern noir like Miller's Crossing or The Man Who Wasn't There, or then sci-fi noir like Blade Runner, obviously. I would not be able to tell you exactly what distinguishes film noir from other kinds of crime thrillers, mind you, but it's one of those things, you know, I know it when I see it.
How about you, Julie? What makes a film noir for you?
Yeah, when is a noir a heist film and when is a noir a drama? So, like Matt, I would go back to the golden era of noir, which is the 40s and the 50s. But we get one of the most famous noir, which is The Maltese Falcon, which is 41, so it's pretty, pretty early. And it has to be, for me, it has to be distinct from the gangster movie genre that we get in the 30s. Sometimes it's lumped in as a sort of proto-noir, but I don't really, I think you need to make a distinction between the Little Caesar and the old Scarface, 1933 one, and the sort of thing that we really associate with noir, which is a loner. Usually can either be a PI or he can be an insurance agent, as we will soon find out, or he can be a policeman. But usually he's in a lonely place. And as soon as we get with the gangs and the gangsters and so on, even though Scarface does have a little bit of the imagery that you associate with noir, which is a little bit of the German expressionism, which you feel throughout the cinematography of noir later, I don't think that's sort of a proto-noir. Really, I really think it's sort of the classic era and everything that pastiches it or even spoofs it or sort of winks towards it. Like L.A. Confidential is a wonderful example because it even harks back to that era, golden age. And that would be what, postmodern or post-noir or modern noir, whatever you want to call it. But for me, film noir is, you know, The Maltese Falcon, The Big Sleep, and the novels have so much to do with them. We tend to think of certain novelists as being very noir, Chandler. And James M. Cain will also come up, who wrote a lot of the material that would later become the scripts of film noir. So I do pin it on an era specific.
I did, like, when I was sort of looking into this and obviously coming across a dictionary definition, I also found, I think it's on, even Wikipedia just has a comment from someone saying, it's like Screwball in the sense that it is impossible to define, but as Matt said, you know it when you see it. And I think there's definitely something in that, that it's, you're at a hiding to nothing to put the absolute parameters on what is film noir and what isn't film noir. But yeah, you'll know it when you see it.
Those two genres surprisingly have a lot in common, but I think that would be a different podcast.
So I think that's sort of a summary of what we think film noir is and possibly isn't. So let's go straight into the films that we've selected, and we'll kick off, we'll do these chronologically with Julie and your choice of film.
Double Indemnity, directed by Billy Wilder, and of course featuring the great, one of the greats of cinema, Barbara Stanwyck. The film is about an insurance agent, as I spoiled earlier, and he has this idea that he's in love or maybe in lust with this married lady, and she doesn't like her husband very much. And he comes up with a very convoluted scheme, an insurance fraud, to make sure that when he dies, they get the maximum amount of money out of his death. And that is the double indemnity of the title. It means that if he sort of has a very freakish accident, the accident policy will give them double the money. That is the idea. Can only be cooked up by an insurance agent. His name is Walter Neff. And this is the entirety of the plot. They need to get rid of the husband. How do they do it? Do they get away with it? Do they not get away with it? This is the entire plot of the film. The plot, as so often with really great classics, is really not the point. You have the voiceover, which is one of those noir tropes that you can find from Blade Runner to Maltese Falcon, which gives it this immediate noir feel where, rather like Sunset Boulevard, obviously also by Billy Wilder, we start with someone narrating the action after it's already taken place. And he is limping and he's bloodied and he's obviously been through a lot and he's dictating into this dictation machine what has happened. Of course, in Sunset Boulevard, the gentleman doing the narrating is already dead. This man is not quite yet dead. So this is an early one and goes back to the era that I just mentioned, which is the sort of the golden era of film noir. And it's a very interesting one because as often in film noir, it has the woman, so the femme fatale, which is a nice trope, but Barbara Stanwyck is so marvelous. It's just such a treat to see what she does with it. The looks that she gives the camera, like you can almost see her mind work. And this Walter Neff character, he thinks he's all that, right? He is like this macho guy. He knows everything and he's so much smarter than she is. And you can just see in her face when she has him by the short and curlies and he's just done for. She doesn't care about him one whit. She doesn't really love him. She doesn't even like him. He's a tool. She does this so splendidly. I don't think anybody else could have gotten away with that at all. Of course, she's gorgeous as well. With a very thin part, she manages to evoke so much. That's really, really what I love about this film. But you can debate, when it came out, it would probably have been marketed as a drama or a melodrama. I think it was sort of called noir years after it was made. So you can even debate, is this even a film noir? Or is this like Mildred Pierce? Also from a novel by James M. Kane, who also wrote the script for this one. Is this actually a noir, or is it just, has it been bombarded into one retrospectively? Also worth noting for people who, listeners who are interested in this kind of thing, it has this wonderful score by Miklos Rosa. It's a very famous classical composer and film music composer, which is just, turn it up really loud. It's gorgeous.
I mean, whether this film is noir, I kind of come to the impression that this is almost like none more noir than this. With the sort of earlier films, and you have the sort of private detective solving a crime who has a sort of level of cynicism to him, this is cynicism on another level. I mean, this is the narrator isn't the guy who's walking the mean streets who's not mean. This is a cynical person who decides to commit a murder, and you're caught up in his story. And I think there's something that is a very successful definition of noir, that it has to have that cynicism, it has to have that fatalism, that some of the sort of the nicely noir shot dramas don't have, because they're still a bit in love with the hero.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in this, it is a cynical universe that has cynical and murderous people. And one of the things I do really like is the main character's friend. So Edward G. Robinson, who plays his friend Keyes, who to some extent investigates the murder as an insurance man. And it's almost a story where he discovers that the universe is cynical. That it's the beginning of noir, that, you know, the nice guys, the heroes, the people who, you know, they have a healthy level of cynicism, but they've got a good moral compass, are going to realize that the whole place is decadent. His best friend is corrupted. It's almost he's entering the world of noir in this film more than any of the detectives do. So I think this is, you know, a great starting point for any discussion of noir, because I think this moves it away from slightly more heroic crime films set in a cynical world to a far more cynical universe.
And how good is Edward G. Robinson in this? Because for classic movie watchers among us, we know him as this gangster type. He's usually the bad guy. I think it's Key Largo, where he's just made up like monstrous and everything. And he's wonderful in this. He's so warm-hearted and funny. And he gives the film the levity that it really needs because, yet, as you say, it's dark.
That's the thing, though. I mean, to me, it, you know, I was wondering about how, what is the tone of the film and how serious is it about the horrible things happening? And to me, at least, it is kind of lighthearted. It's a comedy, I think, almost, but the blackest of black comedies. Because I don't think, at least I didn't feel for any of these characters, really, at least the main characters. I didn't root for them. Whatever bad things may or may not happen to them, there's, I think, no trace of tragedy, which I think there is in both of the other things that we'll be discussing later on. In that respect, I think it's a very Billy Wilder film, you know. The comedy is black and cynical, but it's there. It's, you know, there's a wit in it that I think influences the tone. There's a lightness. If it was music, I don't think it would be, you know, it would not be in the minor key all the way through. And I also think that it's not a moralistic film, even though you could argue that the outcome is moralistic, you know, bad guys get punished. But at the same time, it feels more like, the whole thing feels more like the bleakest of jokes to me. In that respect, I find it very close in tone and in feel to Ace in the Hole.
Yeah, you have a point in the sense that I've seen this movie quite a few times. And every time I wonder what drives these main characters. It's not the money. It's obviously not their, well, quote unquote, love for one another. Something drives them. And it's not really in the story. It is said by Neff that he does this for money and a woman. But nothing in the motivation of the characters shows this. I mean, as it goes for movies of that era, they probably have sex once in his apartment because they smoke cigarettes after. But then again, how do you know? Because they smoke cigarettes all the time. But this is not a romance between those two. And it's also not a heist film as The Asphalt Jungle is, where it is clearly about the money. So what, okay, guys, just, I want to know, what do you think drives these characters?
I mean, I find, which might be telling on myself, I find Neff's journey utterly believable. And I've seen the criticism that it's not clear why he becomes a killer. And I think it is absolutely that he wants to have sex. He wants to be with Barbara Stanwyck. And I think it's a really interesting journey that I think fits the universe of film noir, that he's this sort of insurance industry schlub. He meets this amazing, sexy woman. And at first glance, he's talking the talk. He wants to sound like he's dangerous. He wants to sound bad because he wants to sleep with her. And then when she starts suggesting amoral behavior, he runs to it. He embraces it. It seems very believable to me that he would become someone who ends up killing someone because he's besotted with a woman. I mean, these are the women of film noir. She's a femme fatale. It's fatale. It's not femme annoyance. This is what they do. And I think Barbara Stanwyck sells it, that you think this is a beautiful woman that is utterly amoral, has no moral compass. She's suggested she's killed previously, who wants to kill a husband to get the money and has no second thoughts about it. This is an utterly amoral character. And I think the story is that Neff is drawn to that. He is just a nobody who gets suddenly ensnared by this and it turns him into a murderer. And I absolutely buy that journey because I think his steps towards it seem credible for someone who is desperate to seem more dangerous than they are, to seem like someone smarter than they are, to impress a woman. And I think that's at the heart of this film. I think it makes the character believable when he delivers his monologue, that he's kind of, the spell's been broken, and now he suddenly has a very rational, normal guy's look at what he's done. And so the narrative isn't an embittered, twisted person, or it isn't someone who's still besought. It is someone who's come out the other side of being ensnared in this evil woman's web. And I think it's brilliant. And I think it's one of the highlights of the film to me.
I think you're being a bit easy on him, though, because the thing is, my impression now was, I think I saw it for the second or third time, just in preparation for this podcast. When she kind of hints at what she wants him to do, he's already ready for this. It's like he's, you know, he's been bored at the office, and while bored, he thinks about, so what would be the perfect insurance crime? And how can we get as much money out of this as possible? So you get the impression he's thought about these things before. It's just, so far, it's just been a game to keep himself from falling asleep at work. And now it's combined with, here's this amazingly sexy, tawdry, kind of sleazy, but through this and through her amorality, all the more sexy woman. Hey, the one can combine with the other, and the combination of the two is what gets him hot and bothered, I think.
I've come to the conclusion that in sort of typical Greek tragedy style, this is fate. So it touches on what Matt says, is that somehow all of his life has been working towards this point when the spring is wound and it can only unwind itself one way. This is also the metaphor with you're on the train and you're in it for the whole stretch until the end of the line where is the cemetery, right? It has this really pervasive Greek tragedy feel that even if they wanted to, they couldn't escape this web that they're basically both in, because she, not to be too spoilery, but she just changes her mind at some very pivotal point in the film about who she is. But it's a little bit late then to decide that there's some good in you left. So I think it's very sort of, it has a very classical Greek tragedy, again, this sort of German expressionistic fated feel. And this is something that I see with a lot of noirs where, for instance, the private eye really wants out, but he's drawn in again and again because he can't really escape, but he really wants to, and so on and so forth. So that fated feel, and we'll get onto that a little bit later when we go into something a little bit more modern, is something that I also really associate with noir, this fact that your doom is upon you and there's nothing you can do about it, but, you know, go for the ride.
I think with this one, and I think this chimes on what Matt was saying about it being the blackest of jokes, they create their own doom. I think there's an element to which their own slightly patheticness, this isn't a brilliantly executed plan.
No.
This is a plan executed by two people who think they're smarter than they are. And there's a level to which, as we watch things go wrong, it's going wrong because they haven't executed the perfect plan. And I mean, they come up against Edward G. Robinson and he's sort of slowly working it out, but he's picking up on the mistakes they make. These aren't the cold-blooded, brilliant killers that they kind of hope they can be in their sort of sexual fantasy. And I think that's sort of the fact that they're losers is again another aspect of film noir.
Very true.
The plan is slightly insane, and it was going to go wrong. I think less so that it was fated to go wrong. It goes wrong because these people are a bit naff. and, you know, it goes with the name. Neff is a bit naff, and he's not fated to be a killer. He can imagine this. He can fantasize this. But when push comes to shove, he's going to mess it up. And I think one thing I always think is almost a shame, but that I can't see how they would ever put it in the film, is Edward G. Robinson obviously loves this man, Neff. There is obviously a deep friendship. And you kind of would think if Neff has been rotten to the core all this time, surely his best friend would have picked up on it, that there would have been something that gave away that this person is amoral. So I read that as meaning that this is the man's jump into amorality. He has been a good man. Again, this is the moment where actually his life goes down a different course. And that, I think, is what shocks Edward G. Robinson the most. Which, I mean, just one of the things I thought was interesting reading, researching for this, is he's effectively playing Billy Wilder. And I think people remarked it at the time that a lot of the mannerisms he puts on, the sort of avuncular attitude, the way he addresses people, the sort of almost comic sharpness when he's telling people to leave the room because he's had enough of them, is apparently all Billy Wilder. It's a very good impression of why people liked Billy Wilder. And I do like watching it with that in mind as well.
Mm. In some ways, I think it makes for an interesting counterpoint to something like Rope, the Hitchcock film, where you also have two people who think they're smarter than they really are trying to commit the perfect crime. But I think in Rope, you have clearly two sociopaths. And I was wondering, you know, I think Phyllis and Walter, there's elements there, there's moments there, especially with Phyllis, who's like a snake, you know, he's hypnotizing the gerbil or whatever. There are sociopathic elements there, but with Walter, it's something else. I don't think he's bad. It's more like, you know, he probably, as I said, he was probably, you know, sitting at the office thinking about these things because you're bored and you're annoyed. So you come up with these, you know, plans that if you put them into practice, they'd be horrible and evil. But if it's just, you know, psychotherapy, you know, if you're just sitting there thinking, well, this keeps me from going mad, it's okay. And then he puts them into practice. So I agree, before that, it's not like he was an evil person. Even afterwards, you don't get the impression of him being evil, but you get the impression of him being way out of his depth.
But in a way, it's interesting, I think, if you see it more than once, to try and see it from her perspective. She remains a cipher because he is the narrator. This is what's meant to happen. But she is not as... Barbara Stanwyck doesn't play her as a complete snake. She plays her as somebody who thinks she's more hard-hearted than she is. She thinks that she will not care. She thinks that she can kill and kill again because she needs to. She's probably from a poverty-stricken background. But it does something to her. It's a really brilliant performance. And I think one of the risks in watching this movie is that you do see her like that. And when you start watching it as if it were from Stanwyck's point of view, you get something quite different. It's really well made, and it's really interestingly done, whether she's actually evil or whether she is, in her own way, panic-stricken.
I was wondering about one thing that perhaps also connects with this, the whole sex question, because I think, you know, Walter is quite clearly as horny as they get once he sees her. Since you two talked about the code not too long ago and about, you know, how with the code, it's often said that you had to be more creative with respect to sex and violence, and the two of you didn't quite buy into that argument. Now, I think this is an extremely horny film without ever showing any sex. And I also think that it would not be improved in that respect by showing the sex. Do you think that this is a film that was held back by the code, or that kind of managed to work very creatively with the code?
Yeah, that's always interesting. I think noir in its earliest days was B pictures, basically, Penny Dreadful type stuff. And it's interesting that this sort of trope went into the mainstream, and now they have to deal with the fact that there is sex and violence and murder. And they get away with a lot. It's really, really surprising how much they get away with in a film like this, because nobody can miss the reasons why Walter Neff is attracted to Barbara Stanwyck. It's not because she has a scintillating intellect. He keeps on about her perfume and her anklet, and that's all that he can think about. So it's unmissable. But I suppose they get away with it because it's clever about avoiding showing actual violence. For instance, her husband who is killed in the car. You don't really see anything. But it's obvious what's happening. I don't know. Alan, what do you think?
I mean, you focus on his wife's emotionless face as he's getting killed, which, you know, that puts Barbara Stanwyck firmly in the evil column when it comes to this film, as far as I'm concerned. I think they get away with a lot more because they've set up the story that we're following people who will be punished in the end. And of course, one of the aspects of the code is that wrongdoing could not go unpunished. And I think there's sort of a liberation to what they can write in, because they suddenly realize, rather than sort of being stuck having an ending where people get away with it, we can't have people get away with it, so we have to tack on a feel-good ending. We're now going to tell the story from almost the bad people's point of view. We're going to watch them as they go to their bad end. We're liberated from the concerns of worrying about the code, because they will be punished. We can make them do terrible things and hint that they're up to all sorts of no good, because we know at the end they will be punished. And I think they get away with it for that reason. I think there's something very sort of liberating in that. I also think you could have told that story without the code, but I think it's interesting that knowing that's the rules, they then have some fun with it. I think it's interesting that they allude to sex between Neff and Barbara Stanwyck's character, because I kind of think that might not even have happened, that she would have held out the promise to him, and that was enough to keep him obsessed. And I do think it's one of the wonderful moments in the film where he thinks there is this sort of doomed and dark romance between the two of them that might lead somewhere. And then he discovers that there's just a young man that pretty much on a daily basis is visiting the woman. And it's kind of like, oh, hang on, like I've been superseded. This is obviously like not quite as lustful on her part as I was kind of hoping with, because she's happily finding sex elsewhere. So you have these sort of hints and aspects of darkness to it. I mean, you could have ruined it by showing it more obviously, but also I think you could have easily shown it and made the same film.
Yeah, and clearly with certain genres like melodramas, and also what I very reluctantly keep calling women's film, these are genres that are not always taken seriously as being a serious film. That might have helped as well. If you're like, yes, but you know, it's just a crime drama. Maybe you can get away with things that you wouldn't get away with if you were to make a serious Oscar-bidding crime drama about doomed love. Because it's pulpy, because it has its roots in B-films, I think maybe you can be a bit clever and be a bit more gritty than you would otherwise be allowed to be. Kind of like with horror movies where people get to color outside the lines because, you know, it's just a horror movie. I know we have Jacques Tourneur and everybody's brilliant, but it's just a horror movie. So sometimes I wonder whether that doesn't have something to do with it.
Kind of makes me wonder. I think on the whole, it's probably the prestige drama of the time, at least Hollywood prestige drama of the time, hasn't actually stood the test of time as well as the genre stuff. If we think of, you know, films from the 40s and 50s that we still watch and enjoy watching, it is the screwball comedies, it is the crime stuff, it's Hitchcock and Billy Wilder and so on and so forth.
Well, I don't think that's entirely fair. You just swept the entirety of the golden era of Hollywood under the rug. But no, I think because of the code, well, just because of the mores of the time, but especially in the 50s, because the mores were so hypocritical, his serious films just don't translate well. We're just like, why is he being so stupid? Or why is she being such a, you know, such an idiot? Why don't they just open their mouths and talk it all out and garnish the drama and they can get married and live happily ever after? I don't think that translates well. And if you have this expressionist piece that is very doomy and very, you know, like comic books, I think that that sort of holds up pretty well because it's more abstract, I think, than something that is supposed to be close to life, which, of course, it's not.
I mean, as the sort of genre of film noir, I think Double Indemnity is often given as one of the early noirs, and it's released before the expression gets first coined. So I think there's a lot of films were sort of backdated and put into film noir when the genre was being sort of first defined. So I think it's quite interesting that, like, you know, in the 50s and then into the 60s, you have this notion that people start determining what film noir is. And then I think this leads quite nicely to my choice of film, which would be 1974's Chinatown. I'm going to struggle to give a summary of the film's plot. So it stars Jack Nicholson in his absolute prime. Mid-70s Jack Nicholson is prime Jack Nicholson, as far as I'm concerned. And he plays a private detective who is called on to investigate an affair, which then moves him into an increasingly dark story about corruption in the rapidly developing Los Angeles of the time. And what I think is quite interesting is this film is using ideas, concepts, almost cliches that people understood by that point as amounting to film noir. It's quite deliberately taking these aspects of it and saying, what can we do as a film with it? And I think it's especially interesting because if you look at the sort of fatalism and pessimism that defined film noir in the 40s and 50s, this has become the norm for Hollywood by the mid-70s. This, you know, the whole slate of films that Hollywood would be making would be quite happy with dark endings, with dark characters, with ambiguous morals. And I think, you know, this presents a challenge that if you want to tell this kind of story, what can you do that's different? And I think what's incredible with Chinatown is it goes so much darker. This is possibly, you know, one of the most pessimistic and fatalistic films from the 70s. I mean, it is dark. It is dark to the very end. And there's no Edward G. Robinson turning up to be avuncular and helping us get through this cynical world. This is the cynical world. This is utterly cynical. And even a pretense at heroism, that sort of the private detective who is quite cynical, but his heart, he's a hero, that is presented as the hero in so many sort of early noir films, he's presented as useless in this. It doesn't amount to anything that he has redeemable qualities, that his cynicism hides a more noble sense. It doesn't matter. It's not important. And I think that is why Chinatown is, I think, a brilliant noir film, because it takes the elements of noir. It takes the sort of cliched detective trappings, the stuff that had almost become the stuff of mockery. It takes those, it takes them seriously, and then it tells the most dark of dramas. And I absolutely love it for that. I wondered what you made of it.
Again, it's this powerlessness, isn't it? I mean, we touched on it with Double Indemnity, the sense that the train is running and you'd better hold on because there's nothing you can do. And Chinatown is famous for it. At the end of the line, he has to realize that all through this story, what could he have done? I mean, he's outclassed, outbid, emasculated, and he's helpless. It's just really, quite apart from how bad the story gets, because then be dark places, it's also his realization that he thinks himself a hard man with a heart of gold, but he's just as powerless as everybody else against this massive scheme of corruption that permeates absolutely everything. The stink of it is just inescapable. It's wonderfully done. And I have huge issues with Polanski, but I don't think anybody else could have gone there quite the way Polanski is prepared to do.
I mean, it is definitely a fantastic film. It's one of those films that I think is so perfectly crafted, it almost becomes difficult to say anything about it because it is just, you know, you so quickly then go into, oh, and this is so good, and that performance is so good, and the score works so well, and the cinematography, it's just, it's one of those very few films where I don't see a single thing that I would change about it.
Oh, yeah, but I would. One thing that always irritates me, it always gets to me every single time and sticks with me, is Polanski is in it as an actor. And he is dreadful. He is just, you know, satire. And it strikes completely the wrong note. He's completely one-dimensional. It's an Easter egg, like, ha-ha, Polanski's in it. And it just, it irritates me every single time. It's like, get out of this film, get in the director's chair, and get behind the camera because you're useless in front of it.
I mean, I do quite like it, just in terms of when you go back to the films that it's clearly sort of pastiching, or to some extent it's taking from. You have these curious grotesques that turn up that are two-dimensional. That will do something, you know, a bit daft, and then you'll never see them again. They exist to be, and you know, a knife wielding French dwarf is, you know, it's not what I expected at that point. And he's, you know, he menaces the hero, and then we never see him again. And it is in the sort of style of the story. I think if you know it's Polanski, I can think that can cause a problem because, you know, it's Polanski. But I think if you didn't know that, if this was just an oddity that sort of turned up in a scene, I think it fits the sort of world of the Maltese Falcon and that kind of, you know, gallery of bizarre characters will turn up in a film.
Yeah, but this isn't James Bond. This isn't James Bond where you get to have these bald baddies with a cat. It's just, it takes me out of the story.
Nah, I have to say I'm with Alan on this one. I mean, what you said, I can absolutely see that with respect to someone like Quentin Tarantino, whose cameos in his films are always, you know, But I have to say, yeah, Polanski works for me, and I just love that description of him as a knife-wielding French dwarf, which makes him sound like a Nouvelle Vague version of Don't Look Now.
Yeah.
But I think Chinatown is, I mean, apart from being a fantastic film, it's also a very good counterpoint in some ways to Double Indemnity, because I think in some ways, when most people who think of noir, they think of something like Chinatown much more. I think Double Indemnity has this kind of domestic noir thing, where it's very much contained to these characters and their relationships and their problems. And it totally works. You know, it's not a criticism. But I think Chinatown does this thing where it extends the private and the intimate out into the social and the political, and the multiple levels kind of reflect one another. Corruption that is private, that is familial, is then kind of reflected out into corruption that is political. And that's a type of noir that I think, you know, the two films are very complementary because they show very different kinds of noir, which I really like. That's also why I really like the choice of films that you've made.
Yeah, the corruption angle, it is interesting. I wonder how much of it has to do with budget, for instance. But it's something that LA Confidential also does, you know, quite famously, is that it extends private corruptions and insecurities of people and their domestic issues to world-changing corruption problems. It's also interesting that it's set in Los Angeles and it's in color. So it almost doesn't fall into the trap of winking at itself, which I think is quite a feat because I wouldn't be able to restrain myself, right? To go like, oh, aren't I self-referential? It's what Tarantino would do. But this film, apart from, you know, some weirdo plot points, plays it completely straight. Which I think is ballsy.
I think another thing I love about it as well is the fact that whereas we associate film noir with darkness and the oppression that comes from shadows, this equates oppression with extreme heat.
Yeah.
So you see a city sweltering in a hot summer, which sometimes is alluded to in narration in earlier film noir, but never is captured on screen in the way that it is here. There's a visual style of the intensity of the brightness reflecting the way the characters feel, the sort of intensity of the pressure that they're increasingly coming under. And I think that works incredibly well to sort of turn noir into the light like this, but still maintain the qualities of noir, of this sort of the dangers of the universe. And to some extent, the darkness of the universe is still there, even under the intensity of the brightest sunlight. It doesn't clear the system. It doesn't purge this world of those terrible behaviors. They are still there and they are unrepentantly out in the open.
And also the glamour of it. I mean, this makes it sound like it's really gritty, but it has Faye Dunaway, I think, at her most stunning. There's an enormous glamour to, and the film plays with this too, an enormous glamour to the rich and powerful, which makes the corruption so much more interesting to watch. There's this lovely scene in which Jack Giddy, so has dinner with Houston's character and he gets this dead fish head still on with this eye staring at him on his plate in this really beautiful environment. It's like a hacienda or something. And this is, again, it's such an eye for detail, pointing towards within all this glamour and all these riches and all of that still lurks the kraken of corruption, which is everywhere. It's really well done. It's a lovely scene.
Yeah. We've brought up L.A. Confidential, and I also do think it's a good film, but I have to say I've always been a tiny bit underwhelmed by it because L.A. Confidential to me always felt like someone doing pastiche, you know, someone trying to do a film like Chinatown. And I've been wondering, you know, does Chinatown do the same thing? Because it goes back to the what is it, 30s, 40s. So it's got that kind of retro look, and it could easily be a nostalgic film, but I don't think it is. I think Chinatown, even if it's set in the 30s, it feels very, very modern. It feels very timeless in that respect. And in that respect, I also think that the corruption it talks about on all these levels, you know, the intimate corruption and the political corruption, feels very much of a piece with the 1970s. And I think something like LA Confidential, for me, does not do that to the same extent. That feels much more like it's trying to do what was done back then.
Yeah, and I think the difference is LA Confidential is actual pastiche. I mean, it actually harkens back to film stars or women made to look like film stars of that era. Chinatown, again, plays it straight. It has a historical plot, which is, I think, timeline-wise, probably pretty accurate with the scandal that plays out in this film. Now, LA Confidential does half of that, but it is much more clearly referential and references other films and older films. Chinatown, I don't think it even tries. It just goes like, we need one, the PI, who is cynical but has a heart of gold. Two, we need the femme fatale, who is corrupt through and through until right at the end, in which she sort of kind of changes her mind, but it's a bit too late. We have all these tropes. And then they sort of let it go and say, okay, and this is us tipping our hat to noir. And now we're going to go on to our own story. I think they have different goals, those two films. I don't know if you agree with me.
I totally agree with that, but I would very much disagree with you on the femme fatale. I think that's one of the ways that it does very well and very cleverly. It presents us with someone that we think is the femme fatale, and the main character thinks she's the femme fatale, that she's actually the one who's the danger, who's the trap. But she isn't. The circumstances around her and her father, that's the trap. But she is not trying to screw him over. She is not trying to put him into danger. She's just trying to protect herself and her daughter. So in that respect, I think it's, in a way, it's also because Gittes expects her to be the femme fatale. It's like he's savvy of the tropes of the genre that he treats her horribly.
No, we're not going to agree on this.
I was thinking it's quite interesting because, again, I think Chinatown, rewatching it, thinking from Faye Dunaway's story, I think you do see a very different character once you're able to take a step away from, as a viewer, your initial assumption, she's a femme fatale. It is a very different story if you know how it ends, if you watch the film again. Whereas in contrast with Double Indemnity, every time I rewatch it, Barbara Stanwyck's just even more evil. I mean, she just becomes more calculated and terrible with each watching. Whereas with Chinatown, if you watch it from her point of view, she does seem a much more interesting and not a femme fatale. That it makes you realize that that's not who she was all along. You've been fooled, like the lead detective, into thinking that. And I think that's a really interesting aspect to the story.
Yeah, and that is truly fascinating because I tend to watch people like Stanwyck, rather like Babyface, right? The fact that these women don't get fleshed out and the fact that they stay a cipher doesn't mean that they were born wicked. And the interesting thing that Chinatown does is that it puts the spotlight on that fact. But you have this lovely scene where Gittes and Faye Dunaway's character have lunch or brunch or breakfast or whatever. And she is quite candid about that. She sleeps around. And she plays this out like, okay, look, you've seen me. You know the type of person I am. I sleep around. I don't stick with partners very long. Obviously, that makes sense by the end of the film, why she became that way. But I keep thinking this is just a light switched on the femme fatale that was always there. I mean, look at the Maltese Falcon. And maybe Stanwyck is a bit of a bad example because she plays it so importantly well. But look at these femme fatales. They are only flattened in that way because they are perceived in a certain way. It's just the same way Gittes perceives Dunaway. The fact that it's not true in the end, and the movie addresses that, that's what LA Confidential does as well, where you have the femme fatale between quotes and who turns out to be just a girl from the sticks. It's just a matter of where you point the flashlight, I always feel.
But I think there is definitely an aspect of the femme fatale in noir that a lot of the time they are being deliberately manipulative. And I think it's interesting when you see the story of what they're doing. So they often turn up as the beautiful victim, and then you very quickly learn, or they will admit to having a little bit of a dark side. They will admit they're not perfect. They will admit they've had they've done some not great things, but that they're still the damsel in distress that the detective needs to rescue, which in quite a few film noir is still all part of the act. They're still all underneath it all. This is how they know they can get a cynical detective on board. If they just played good and naive and innocent from the outset, then the detective would never fall for it because he'd be like, nobody's that good. But if they go, well, I do have this slight dark side. I have behaved in a way that society would judge as amoral. I think you see in Chinatown, again, it fits what Gittes is thinking. This is a femme fatale. This is a dangerous woman. This is the sort of woman that, even though I think in this instance, it's just a woman being honest. It is not a woman that is trying to lure him into like the fatale bit of femme fatale. She's being honest. It's us alongside the lead character that still thinks in terms of the woman luring the man into this sort of corrupt and dangerous world that, or effectively a trap.
Yeah, exactly. Because that's what the femme fatale is. It's a perception. Look at films like Niagara, which also turns that, it's not as good a film, but it also turns that perception on its head a little bit. That's what the femme fatale is. It's just the perception of the voiceover narrator, just to be simple about it. None of it is real. And this is what fascinates me about noir as a genre too, is the women get to be a little bit mean, a little bit nasty, a little bit wicked. They get to sleep around. They get to murder people. And I know they're not rewarded for it, but they, as women, are so much more interesting than the more domesticated, put on a pedestal, virginal mother. And that's something that has always attracted me to noir, is that they get to play around with this a little bit. And if you put the flashlight on a little bit differently on a Stanwyck character, you might get Babyface, who is prepared to go a long way to be affluent. So it's really hard for me to disentangle these impressions that I have of these characters, even though it may not be in the script. But the woman is just the perception of the woman from the point of view of Marlowe, for instance.
I have to say, again, I'm probably a bit more with Alan here, because I think there is a clear difference between someone like the Barbara Stanwyck character, or like the women in The Last Seduction or Grifters, where they are fatal, literally fatal.
Deadly.
To the protagonist, yeah. And I don't think, I think actually in Chinatown, that's turned around. In the end, it's Gittes who's fatal to Faye Dunaway's character. Because he, by trying to be the knight in shining armor, he tries to be the good guy and do the right thing and bring the criminal to justice. And because of that, he goes and faces Noah Cross and tells him, I know what you did and everything. And because of all of that, in the end, it's that Noah Cross finds his daughter and the horrible things ensue. So the one who's actually fatal is our hero and not the woman.
Yeah, but that's the same thing goes for Double Indemnity. If you just look at the way the plot plays out, who is killed by whom in the end, right? I mean, think about it. Again, this is because we are listening to Neff from the start of the film until the end. And again, it's like, where do you put the flashlight? He is the one. He is the murderer of the two. And we are meant to think of Stanwyck as the spider in the web. But is she? You know, it's really fascinating stuff. And I know Double Indemnity's script doesn't quite bear this out. But if you look at the genre on the whole, from this point of view, it gets really very interesting very, very quickly.
I think there's sort of an interesting part if you look at something like The Maltese Falcon and the femme fatale in that, where the end is the sort of heroic detective realizing that he cannot trust her. There cannot be a relationship. They cannot go off together happily at the end, which is a little bit of what happens in The Big Sleep, because of this factor, because he's realized that there might be an interpretation that she's genuine and has been forced to behave like this because of the circumstances of trying to survive. Or it could be that she has been actively scheming from the outset, and he has been part of her plot from the outset, and he will be dumped the moment he stops being useful to her. And it's his realization that that is an option. That is probably, or possibly, who she is as a person that really sort of makes something of the end of the film. And I think where I do think Chinatown plays this slightly differently to these is, I think by the end, we come to realize that she wasn't that. And it is still tragic that the assumptions that she was maybe someone who was manipulating, someone who had a greedy outcome in mind, who had a gain that they wanted to get out of this, who was scheming and plotting for their own sake, which, you know, you'll carry over from Double Indemnity, you'll carry over from The Maltese Falcon. We approach Chinatown with the baggage of all these films that she immediately sees like that character. And the darkness, the tragedy at the end is that she isn't that character. That she was someone who, if you watch it again, all her actions make sense from someone who is in a horrible situation and is being honest. She's honest, you know, so much of the film. She's saying actually how she feels. And I think we, as the viewer, alongside Jack Nicholson, just doesn't trust her because she's a femme fatale. And because we're carrying this baggage from all the films we've seen where these women are wrong-uns and they ensnare and doom men.
No, but and this is a credit to Dunaway, because I think this bears mentioning. Same with Stanwyck. Dunaway, of course, is a unique actress. I know what happened to her, and I know that she's done some weird stuff. But this is what she does. She does this completely poker-faced, really poised version of honesty that I very much doubt another actress could do quite in that way. It's also what Stanwyck is so incredibly good at. And it's this straight face, it's this poker face that makes us doubt, is she who she says she is, right? It's really, really well done by probably one of Dunaway's very, very best performances. And that's what makes the film. If she hadn't been that good, they couldn't have done the little twist thing, you know, that the script allowed them to do. And it is the fact that she has been truthful throughout that makes her end so tragic. But again, Giddies slaps her about. And do you remember the part in The Maltese Falcon right at the beginning where Bogey and Mary Astor have this conversation about her being a liar? Mm. And she says, look, I don't have any money. What do you want with me anyway? And he kisses her really hard. And it's quite obvious what's going on there. So there's also this part where the, I don't want to call them the abuser, but this power player in this dynamic thinks he can just slap people around because they're women and they're still the good guy. So to me, again, there is more nuance in these older films than you maybe give them credit for, although I do absolutely admit and agree 100% that Dunaway's performance and the room that the script gives her are unique in the genre. This is true. But we do tend to look at the older films with a little bit of myopia, I sometimes think.
Just one more point I was going to make about Chinatown when we've sort of mentioned corruption is that this reflects a real corruption that took place in Los Angeles at the time. And I think that, again, is another interesting because we've approached an era in the 70s where the characters from detective fiction, from the film noir of the 40s and 50s, are starting to be seen as heroes. They're the hero in a slightly cynical world, but they triumph. And they triumph against the slightly dodgy guy who lives in a big house. They triumph against a dodgy criminal with a foreign accent. But I think Chinatown makes the point that it is ubiquitous. When you look back at this era, don't think this is just one tiny bit of society. This was the system. The system is utterly corrupt. And everything you've seen in classic film noir is almost trickle-down corruption to the low level where the sort of detectives have been operating. But actually, Chinatown is very much saying the whole system is rotten. I think that's something that LA Confidential does quite well in a similar way of saying, look, this is corruption that goes all the way out. But I think LA Confidential almost can't quite avoid giving us a triumph over it. Sort of saying by the end of the film, we're moving in the right direction. This terrible situation, well, some of the key exponents have gone and maybe our heroic heroes will find a way to deal with them. I think LA Confidential has to give the sort of Hollywood ending along those lines. Whereas Chinatown is, this level of corruption is so great, you do not know what's going on. And that means that if you try and take it on like a private detective, you don't know what you're doing. It might not work. And I think that's the sort of central message of Chinatown, which again, I think is a little bit meta, but it is referencing so much of film noir and saying there is more to the world than maybe even these cynical films taught you. And I think that's one of the reasons why it's genius. And looking at a film that sort of tackled elements and tropes of the genre, I think that takes us nicely to Matt, your choice of film.
Okay, so we're now jumping about 30 years to 2005 and to Rian Johnson's Brick. Perhaps just, again, a very brief synopsis, at least, of the outset of the film. So what Brick does, it basically takes the hard-boiled, noirish detective story, but it sets it at a California high school. What Johnson does is he does something like postmodern parody, although parody not in the sense of all these horrible, you know, what are they called? You know, the date movie or the disaster movie or whatever. It does something more intricate, something possibly more clever, possibly also something annoying in a different way by fusing those different worlds and tones and genres. So you've got the high school student Brendan, played by Joseph Gordon-Levitt, in one of his pretty early roles, I think. He receives a call from his ex-girlfriend, and this call basically gets him involved in a story of love, drugs, and murder in and around a high school. So perhaps less so than a plot synopsis, it's important to say what the film does and what it feels like. So most of what we see, the characters, plots, motifs, are basically noir tropes refracted through the tropes of the American high school. So you've got Brendan, the smart, aloof, arrogant loner, is basically the equivalent of the cynical, heart-bitten detective. He's got a past that basically is romantic, but it's also, it makes him into this jaded cynic. You've got the high school vice principal, who's played by Richard Roundtree, who's basically the equivalent of the chief of police. And you've got a scene that's very much like one of those scenes, just set in the vice principal's office. You've got the local 20-something drug baron. He's basically the equivalent of the criminal kingpin. You've got dialogues that are straight from the handbook of 40s noir. The rhythm, the tone, the jargon, so much so that, again, some audience members found this highly annoying. I think I always take at least 10 minutes to get into this before I stop finding it annoying. It's turned up to a point where it's practically absurd. But at the same time, I think while Johnson has fun with the tropes, I don't think he makes fun of the tropes, because his film still has, how should I say this? He's not trying to make, a parody in the kind of sucker sense, sucker Abrams sucker. It's a parody in the sense that it uses both of these kind of sets of tropes in order to make something fresh. So the both of you, you'd seen it before, I think. You rewatched it for this podcast. What is your take on the film? Let's perhaps start with Alan.
I think I agree with you. I think when I first saw it, it took me a while to sort of get into what it was doing. And then sort of 10 minutes in, I realized that this is the world of a classic film noir. But it's a story told in a high school. And I sort of enjoyed it for that. And I think it's not pastiche, but I think it's playful in the sense that when they introduce new characters, you kind of see how that does work as a credible high school analog to something you'll have seen in film noir before. On the rewatch, which I thought was really interesting, is since I'd seen it previously, I'd read a lot about the theory that came up that the original noir detectives or the original pulp detectives, that actually they were the Hollywood screenwriters. And the concept is that, you know, you had people who thought they were idealists, who thought they could be great, turning up at Hollywood and finding themselves crushed by the system. Crushed by this cynical world, struggling for money, doing stuff they had to for money, and that they sort of channeled this into creating the private detective who exists very much in the world that they felt they were living in. Because, I mean, you don't have to read much to realize that private detectives at that time were nothing like these characters. I mean, it was a business. It was an effective industry. The notion of the sort of lone PI or the PI with a partner he doesn't like, analogous, I think, with a writing colleague you don't get on with anymore, where you don't think they've got the talent that you have. And the theory sort of posits that this is where this character comes from. It comes from writers, especially sort of New York writers operating in Hollywood. And I think what is quite interesting is if you look at it, this view on the outsider, the private detective is a way of commenting on the outsider. That also fits perfectly into the world of teenagers. It is an absolutely perfect fit for that story to then say the guy who's the teenage outsider, the one who doesn't quite fit into any of the gangs, you can tell that story because relationships in school and among teenagers, that will be labyrinthine, that will be a minefield. There will be feelings you have you can't trust, and there will be people who will exploit those feelings. And this just celebrates that as an analogy, and I think plays with it, has fun with it. And it's definitely something that I think this is what an independent low-budget film does really well. I think it's probably a fair criticism that there's not a huge amount of depth, that it works as this sort of relocating a type of story to a new environment. And that's very much just what the film is. But, you know, a low-budget film can do that. A relatively short, low-budget film, doing that and executing it as perfectly as this film does, just works. That's enough for a film to do. Yeah, no, I really sort of enjoyed this when I first saw it, and I enjoyed it more on the rewatch.
Yeah, I agree with Alan. I read it almost immediately as pastiche. And I don't mind pastiche being pastiche. It's not annoying just because it's pastiche. But what elevates this film is that it's also about high school. And I think you have this sort of, I know this analogy is maybe not the best, but it's a sort of Edward Scissorhands theme, right? Like, he's obviously the one who doesn't fit in with any of the cliques. He has long since given up trying. There is this wealth disparity that's made very clear. We have the wealthy children of the wealthy parents, and you have our lone detective who can't even get his shoes repaired. So there are themes there that elevate this little, and I think it's a nice little pastiche, because Johnson clearly adores the genre, but it's elevated by this sort of understandable environment where we were all in high school, and it gets nasty. It really does get that Machiavellian, maybe not quite that bad, but we sort of can all see how bad this can be. And it's not taken seriously by adults because these are teenagers. And the themes that are touched upon, like drug use, like the way that drugs are monetized and who it victimizes, are very sort of serious. That's serious stuff. And I love the way that he juggles those things. And it's one of these films that he's done where his love of genre and his knowledge and also the story and the fun he has gel together very well, like Knives Out, also one of my favorites that he's done, where he also uses these genre tropes to tell quite a different kind of story. And even thematically, I think, they sort of get quite close every once in a while. So yeah, I'm with Alan all the way.
I mean, it's interesting that Veronica Mars, the TV series, I think it started around a very similar time, and that also takes very much noir tropes and sets them in kind of sunny California at a high school. And I do think it's the extent to which noir and its tropes have become such so codified that probably makes it so easy to transpose into the high school, because high school also has these tropes that are clearly codified, you know, the jock, the nerd, the principal, all of these things. You can really take one cliche and another cliche and do a kind of mapping and then have fun with that. And I think both Veronica Mars and Brick have fun with it. It's a weird thing. I mean, I would agree with you, Alan, that it doesn't go all that deep. I mean, it's also a short film. It's a small film, and it is purposefully that. In terms of the emotions, though, I think, you know, it doesn't have it doesn't feel like a cynical joke that in a way is funny, but not heartfelt. I think, as I said, Double Indemnity to me is not a tragedy, because what happens to these characters, you don't feel sorry for them. You don't root for them in that sense. And I think the emotions are there in Johnson's film in Brick, even though if you try to decode them on a plot level, I mean, I still get a headache when I try to figure out what exactly the plot of Brick is. And then I go back to Wikipedia and I still can't quite figure out who does what, why. But I think I said so at the very beginning when we talked about just what is noir to us. And I said that in some ways it's almost like music. It's a certain sound. It's a certain feel. And I think the sound and feel is totally there in Brick, even though you have to first work through the parody aspect, the postmodern aspect. And I think the tragedy is also there, even though it's not borne out by a plot that really carries it. Death matters. It's not the kind of universe where death doesn't matter. There's a killing in the film, and the way it's done in the film, even though you've got scenes that are funny and also played for laughs, it's shocking. It's one of the most shocking gunshot to the head scenes that I've seen. And not because it's gory, but because of the lead up, because of the tone that's established.
And also, what I love, I think Joseph Gordon-Levitt's part is like, he gets to be Bogey. He gets to be our ideal of Humphrey Bogart in The Big Sleep or in any of his sort of better noir films. I know Bogey hated doing them, but still. And I think the sort of joy of being that icon, that really translates to me as well. So also, of course, it's a heartfelt film. They take it seriously, these teenagers and their suffering. But also the sheer joy of making it really translates to me. Just if I were Joseph Gordon-Levitt and I got to do Bogey 2.0, I would be so excited. So I think it's a good balancing act with giving you as a viewer that joy, but also taking your characters seriously and being careful with your characters, not just gunning them down willy-nilly. The only issue that I have is Lucas Haas, who's a lovely actor. I'm so sorry he went into music because I like him so much as an actor. But he has these weird outfits, which is too James Bond evil guy for me. But otherwise, I think it sort of gels. It's one of these things that pulls off a very neat little balancing act, doesn't it? It's worth seeing just for that.
Absolutely. By the way, I found it an interesting tidbit that, you know, Johnson had his cast read Hammett, obviously, but he explicitly told them not to watch any film noir. What he did tell them to do was to watch Billy Wilder and other screwball comedies.
Yeah. again, I wish we could sort of write a book about this, because the similarities between the early screwball comedies and the early noirs really, really are stunning.
I think also in relation to the character of the pin, I do think that there's an element to which we're watching the lead enjoy being Bogart. We're now seeing another teenager who is making money, making drugs, enjoy being a noir kingpin, the bad guy who's a bit more sophisticated, who fancies himself as the cultured person who's involved in crime. And I think I can forgive that he's got a room in the cellar that has a falcon statue in it. I think you can read that meta, but I think you could also read it as the character enjoying playing the role he's got in a noir story. There is something that there's a lovely scene in it when they're having a discussion between the lead and the pin while the pin's mother is getting him something to drink and is behaving as a very conventional mother to their own teenager. So that although there is a very reality to it that does lead to murder, that does lead to really quite terrible and scary stuff, this feels like a parallel world taking place alongside almost the normalcy of what the parents are doing. And again, I think that sort of... it is this sort of created world of, in this case, not the underclass, it's just the teenagers, that I find is really interesting. And the extent to which the film enjoys playing with them in their roles, but to some extent, maybe even the characters are, that they're into their position in it. Yeah, no, that's something that I sort of really enjoy with it. There's also the scene on the beach where the pin, to express how cultured he is, starts talking wistfully about Tolkien. Mm-hmm. Which is so teenager. That just hits that sweet spot, whereas before you might have had the noir, sophisticated bad guy revealing he had a love of opera or he had a sophisticated taste in art and that helps drive him into crime. Now we've got a teenage boy loving Tolkien. And it's played in the same way. And I think that's another of the sort of, again, it's fun that this film is having.
But there's a tenderness to it. And again, it reminds me of the Falcon. The dialogue between the fat man and Bogey, right? Where they I don't even know what their dialogue is about. Yeah, it's about a jewel encrusted falcon in some way. Nobody cares. It's about this highfalutin language, and it doesn't matter really what it means. And this sort of, with a great deal of tenderness, sort of harkens back to, it really doesn't matter what book you pick. It could have been Alice in Wonderland. It could have been bloody Narnia. And there's this, you know, great understanding of sometimes they don't make sense and they really don't have to. I mean, The Big Sleep, I don't think anybody understands what happens to the chauffeur. Even now, we don't care. It's not the point. That's what Brick does so well. As Matt said, there's no use in trying to unravel what exactly the plot is, because it doesn't matter. Like in the best noirs, nobody cares.
I think one thing I would kind of criticize about the film, though, I mean, I do think it's a Marmite-y film. I think, like postmodernism very often is, it can rub people the wrong way. Meta rubs people the wrong way very often. I totally understand that. It may not be for you. But I think one thing the film really doesn't do all that well, disappointingly, is I think it doesn't do its female characters a lot of justice, compared especially to the other two that we've seen. We've got the, in a way, the victim of the piece, Emily, the ex-girlfriend played by Emily Durava, who was in Lost. And again, I think the feeling is there. You feel the sadness that's there, but it's also always reflected through the male main character. She doesn't really become much of a character, Emily does, nor does the femme fatale of this film, Laura. I think, in a way, she really is not much more than the trope. She's got one or two nice scenes, but I really think that, in a way, Rian Johnson got a bit carried away with all the male tropes of his noir parody pastiche, and I kind of wish the female characters had worked better in this one. I don't know, how do you guys see that one?
Doesn't really bother me. I mean, I think it's because it's a pastiche of a genre which is not very friendly to women to begin with. I can sort of accept that a pastiche of that same genre will not suddenly be all Me Too. I can accept that because of what it is. They get a pass because of what they're trying to do. They're trying to look at a genre sideways and having a lot of fun with it.
I guess that's the thing. I just find that the film has so much more fun with Brendan and with the pin and with the male characters. And the women there, it just doesn't have that sense of fun to the same extent, I kind of feel. What do you think, Alan?
No, I think it is quite interesting that the sort of femme fatale character in this never has much of a moment to be femme when it comes to the lead. There's not much of a dynamic between her and the lead in it. So I think you'd almost want a bit more the suggestion that Brendan did fancy her, that he could be led astray by her. That, I think, would be more noir, that they would give the two of them scenes that would play out. I mean, the thing is, which I think fits the character where Brendan is, where he's heartbroken, is that he's so defensive and hostile from the outset to everyone, including the film's femme fatale. I mean, you never get a sense that he trusts her. He always thinks he's suspicious. Which then, by the end of the film, when it comes to him revealing that he's to some extent worked out exactly what happened, and the femme fatale is properly fatale again, in that meaning of the word, it doesn't feel like he's been betrayed. It doesn't feel like an emotional twist that he's had to suffer. Which I think, going back to the Maltese Falcon, is very much where you are with Bogart. That he has this realization that if he can't trust this person, they do not have a romantic future. In Brick, it's just, well, she's in this film to be pretty, she's in this film to seem reasonable, and then turn out to be utterly deceitful. That fits the type of story. But especially in a high school, and the way hormones and teenage crushes work, I think that's probably the one parallel that this film is missing, is the sort of equating a teenage crush with the way that the detective or the sucker like Walter Neff falls for the femme fatale. There's a lovely overlap here, and I think they can't quite tell it in this story because they need Brendan to be heartbroken, and they need his ex to be the character in trouble that he wants to help.
Yeah, who deserves saving. And I think the reason that I give this a pass, that it's one of the sort of tropes of film noir, is that the women are always ciphers. They are never revealed completely, which is what you indicated, that's different about Chinatown. They are ciphers. So, and I'm all right with, Brendan needs to be on a quest to save somebody who's worth saving. This is a thing, apparently, that they've decided. But the fact that the women are complete ciphers is something that I think is endemic. It's like a sort of a part of the genre, that it's a very male point of view, a very solipsistic genre, which makes all the women to be these cardboard cutouts. You have no idea what goes on behind their eyes, which I can accept if it makes them a little bit flat. That's not everybody can be Chinatown, right?
But I think, you know, even in the world of stereotypes and two-dimensional ciphers, you've got a feeling that Joseph Gordon-Levitt, we mentioned, he's having fun being Bogart. And then Lucas Haas is having fun being the criminal kingpin. And you almost would have wanted the actor playing Laura to have had the fun of being the Barbara Stanwyck, of being the dangerous, someone who is enjoying filling this role in a noir story. I think that is a missed opportunity in this film, because they are really interesting characters. They are great characters when you see them in. I think Barbara Stanwyck is just incredible in Double Indemnity. There is so much to enjoy in her performance, just, I think, for its wickedness. The scene where she's staring practically at the camera while you hear her husband off camera being murdered. It would have been nice to find, I don't know how you do it, which is maybe why it isn't get done, but it would be nice to have found a teenage analogue for a teenager who is that amoral and that wicked. Because she is in this. If you look at what she does, the presentation is of someone who is quite terrible, but we never see her having fun with that. The closest we get, I think, is the very end, when she says something she probably didn't need to say just to piss off Brendan. And I think he is a final knife in his heart because she can. And I just think there could have been more of that. But again, I don't know how you'd fix it. So maybe they did try and they just thought, we can't fit it into this narrative.
It might just be a question of casting also, because I've seen the actress, Nora Sehetna, no idea if I pronounced that correctly, in other things, and she's usually okay, but she usually remains a bit of a non-entity. And I think possibly that's just it. Perhaps you would have needed an actress who just comes off the screen more strongly than that to fill the cliche with life and with fun. It's a minor thing. I mean, I definitely don't think that the film is bad because of that. I just think that, especially compared to the two other films that we have, it is a bit of a weakness.
In fairness, we're comparing her to Faye Dunaway and Barbara bloody Stanwyck. Who can stand up to that? I mean, I ask you.
No, that is fair. That is harsh competition. Coming third on that list is not, it's not
bad.
That's
not fair.
Those are the sort of the three noir films that we were hoping to look at. Do we think that as a genre, it has much of a future? I mean, do you see that there's much noir happening today? Or do you think that maybe it's a genre whose time has come and gone?
We have so many of them, don't we? I mean, just think of the sci-fi options that you have with these very sort of familiar themes. right? You have Altered Carbon, the series with Joel Kinnaman, which has a very noir feel. Of course, there's Blade Runner, but that's a little bit older. But I'm thinking towards, or maybe that's just wishful thinking on my part. I'm thinking towards the sort of, what if your femme fatale was an AI? We've seen flashes of it in cinema, and there are several very nice sort of sci-fi horror film noir type smaller films. I think that is going to be, if somebody gets that right, it's going to be a roaring success. I would love to see more of that.
Yeah, I definitely think, you know, I would not expect a new Chinatown anytime soon. I think, as I said, with LA Confidential, that already felt like it was basically trying. It felt a bit like cosplay. Very good cosplay, but cosplay nevertheless. Someone dressing up as Chinatown. And I'm not sure, you know, I think if that's done well, I'm definitely there for it, but it's not something I absolutely need. I think there's definitely noir in other genres, like cyberpunk very often has this kind of noirish feel to it. I think there's postmodern noir. I wouldn't actually want a director to say, hey, I want to do a noir film. But if a director or a writer has material that lends itself to these tropes, to these formats, to the sound and feel of noir, absolutely. If someone tells a story about corruption, if someone tells a story, you know, that is close to these cliches, absolutely make use of those cliches, because I do think that there's nothing completely new under the sun, and definitely not on cinema screens. And that's okay. You're always reflecting what has come before. You're always commenting on what has come before. And just like there can still be Westerns, they just need to know where they're coming from and what they're doing with that. I think you can also have noir that also is aware of the tradition, perhaps plays with it, perhaps comments on it, or perhaps just has fun with it.
But think of Sin City. I mean, that's the noirest of noir with a splash of red that I can think of. Frank made it Sin City. And that was a huge success as far as I remember. So I think there's life in the old bird yet.
But I think also with Sin City, I think you probably have the idea that it is carrying on because of its familiarity. Because it's saying, you know these, and if we hone film noir down to, I think, the aspects that both Chinatown and Brick play with. So you've got the sort of loner detective, you've got the sort of weird collection of characters on the underbelly that they're interacting with. It's become its own cliche, and it's popular partly because of its history, that people go, well, I know where I am with the story. I know what's going to happen because it has those elements. But whether that means that it has the capacity to surprise us in future. And I think what I always find quite interesting is, I think Blade Runner is a very interesting translation of those elements to a science fiction environment. But my sort of complaint about the Blade Runner sequel is it told the least interesting character story in the film, because it was wedded to who is the most like the sort of cynical, downtrodden PI type character. Well, let's have him doing an investigation. And on that investigation, he keeps meeting these characters that I think would be a more interesting film. It helps it stay popular because everyone recognizes what's happened. But also, it kind of means you're stuck telling a type of story. And I do wonder whether it's time to, you know, put the sort of crumpled detective to bed for a bit. And you can still tell cynical stories, still tell stories set in a corrupt world, but we don't need this private detective or private detective analog anymore, because that's too well known and too much. Like, the moment you see it, it's almost like when you go see a pantomime in this country, and just, we know what's going to happen now. And we enjoy it because it's familiar. And I think both Chinatown and Brick are really interesting in the fact that they engage with the tropes. But I think they also show how limited they can be. I don't know whether you can make another Chinatown with those tropes. It's been done. And similarly, I don't think you could make another Brick. I think if you just were to say, we're translating all these tropes to a different environment, and we're going to tell an absolutely straight style noir crime story in this new environment. Again, we've seen Brick. I think the mileage is limited. So I do wonder whether now it's too easy to carry on making noir in that sense. And now's the time to refocus our cynical and corrupt stories.
Well, when we were going to do this podcast, Matt talked me out of it, but I almost brought a film called The Last Seduction, which is a noir film which focuses on the femme fatale. And the femme fatale in this case is not a redeemable, golden heart type woman. She is a criminal psycho. And the story is told from her point of view, where everybody's a dope. I didn't bring it because it would complicate matters, but that is a type of story that I think still has a future in it. And that's a lot of fun to watch.
That's the thing, refocus. So, you know, we sort of mentioned Double Indemnity. What is Barbara Stanwyck's story? You're looking at them from a different angle. The same events is already sort of a starting point, which doesn't get done enough. Science fiction is still, or other genres are still raiding film noir for its loner, cynical detective. And I think it's maybe is time for more of the femme fatale.
I don't think either of you has probably seen Under the Silver Lake, right? By David Robert Mitchell. It's not a perfect film. I'm not even sure whether it's a good film, but I think it does some things very right in that respect, because it takes a lot of the tropes, but it looks at them with a more honest eye, where you've got the main character who kind of thinks he's the kind of loner, cynical detective type who can figure things out, who can save the girl, who knows who's the femme fatale and who isn't. But really, he's just a toxic male who hasn't grown up yet. There's more to the film than that, but I think that kind of thing, you know, looking at the elements that have become codified and critiquing them, or just looking at, you know, what's the underbelly of that? What's the flip side of that? Or what is this if we look at it honestly? There's definitely potential there.
Mm. Well, I think on that optimistic note of the potential of the genre, I think we can leave it there. So thank you, Julie. Thank you, Matt. And join us next time for another episode of Damn Fine Cup of Culture.
Bye-bye.
Goodbye.